Shalom and welcome to Israel Policy Pod. I'm your host, Chinni Reichman, Director of IPF Atid at Israel Policy Forum, hosting the Emergency Wartime Podcast, Week 3, where I'm going to be interviewing your usual host, Neri Zilber, a journalist based in Tel Aviv and a policy advisor at Israel Policy Forum. Hi, Neri. How are you?
Hi, Chinni. It's good to be back with you. Week 3 of this war. Happy to answer any questions. And it's going to go on for a bit, you know, a bit and a lot longer. So, like I said last week, I appreciate these check-ins for you and our audience.
Absolutely. I'm going to start us off with a glimmer of hope that we had this week, which is that two more hostages were released, two elderly women released from Hamas captivity. Unfortunately, their husbands are both still in captivity, along with 200 or more than 200 other hostages who remain in Gaza. But we're very grateful to see that these two women were brought home to Israel.
Yeah, that's right. And we should mention that since last time we recorded, two additional ones were released, I believe, last Friday night. So it's a total of four women released. The first two actually were American citizens, not actually dual citizens. But last night, or the night before, rather, it was two actual Israeli citizens. And yes, it's these releases come usually around 8-9 o'clock at night. No real prior warning. There are usually sketchy reports that something is afoot. And then they're released to the Red Cross in Gaza, and then are transported to the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt, and then very quickly brought back into Israel. And so all of these releases are very, very welcome. It is, like you said, a glimmer of hope. And Hamas likes to portray it as a humanitarian gesture, and we can get into the logic behind them releasing hostages in this kind of drip. But each one of these people is an entire life, an entire world. So everyone is quite grateful, while still keeping in mind that Hamas, as we record this, is still holding over 200 people, mostly Israelis, but not only Israelis. And those include very young people, very young kids, babies, still very elderly women, as well as, like you said, men. So a lot more work needs to be done. And this afternoon, there were some reports, so maybe people will be a bit smarter once they listen to this podcast, but that Qatar was trying to broker perhaps another hostage release package, but that has yet to come to fruition. But there seems to be something in the works behind the scenes.
That's really great to hear. And thanks for that, Neri. All the days blend together. So I thought when we hosted last, those other two hostages, the mother and daughter from Chicago, had already been released. So thank you for that.
Right.
At this rate, though, it will be a very long time before we see everyone released. So hopefully there will be more progress on that front.
Absolutely. I think everyone wants it to happen. The Israeli public. And also, by the way, the Biden administration has made this a priority. To get hostages out, especially American citizens. French President Emmanuel Macron was here yesterday, and he actually met with several of the relatives of the hostages, very much embraced them. So everyone is very keen to have this happen. And obviously, the question needs to be asked, why is Hamas releasing in this kind of drip fashion? Like I said, I think it's trying to maybe mend a lot of the damage, at least in terms of public relations globally, that was done by its own hands, by its own soldiers' hands and terrorists' hands on October 7th. That's number one. Number two, the potential or the possibility of more hostages being released is one factor. It's not the only factor, but it's one factor in this delay in what everyone expects to be a very significant Israeli ground operation into the Gaza Strip. So both external and internal influences and actors are trying to counsel patience to the Israeli government to at least allow more time for perhaps more hostages, we hope, to be released.
Let's stay on this vaguely optimistic note, and we'll talk a little bit about Israeli civil society, which, you know, we're continuing to see some really remarkable stories. Of course, so many farms within the kibbutzim along the Gaza border were left abandoned after the farmers were murdered. And so Israelis have been, you know, regular Israelis harvesting tomatoes and milking cows and really working the farms kind of across the south. We have psychologists donating their time to orphans and families of hostages who need support, and of course everyone helping gather equipment for the IDF and all of the necessities for the, I believe it's 200,000 displaced individuals. So speaking of that, of course it's beautiful and special to see Israeli society stepping up in this moment, but for the long term, there are obviously going to be a lot more needs met, more than individual volunteers can handle. So can you share with us the status of the displaced families? I did hear that tent cities are being set up in the absence of sufficient hotel rooms because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I just heard the number 60,000 hotel rooms in Israel, which is not enough for 200,000 people. So if you can share more about that situation. And of course, I'll remind our listeners that it's not just Israelis in the south who were evacuated by the kibbutzim, but also along the northern border in anticipation of a potential Hezbollah attack from the north.
Right. I mean, look, big picture, this is an entire complete society mobilization. And I've written about this and seen this firsthand. It really is in a very dark time, one of the few rays of light that we've seen, everybody pulling together. So like you said, whether it's people going and farming these farms on the Gaza frontier, whether it's people actually paying for hotel rooms for displaced, because the government still is finding it difficult to get its act together. It's people donating either supplies or money or their time to go and equip and feed soldiers, whether standing army or reservist. I've seen this and know about it firsthand over the weekend. People going and cooking for the soldiers in the staging areas and various bases in the south. You know, it's restaurants and cafes sending food to either hospital staff or to the soldiers. It's everything. It's everything. Everyone is fully mobilized, and it actually is quite remarkable to see because prior to October 7th, as we know from this podcast, Israeli society was very much divided, and the official slash unofficial tagline of everything going on since October 7th inside Israeli society has been together we can win, together we will win. And that is on T-shirts, it's on billboards. It really is the motto of an entire nation. And so everyone's pulling together, and that is quite remarkable to see, you know, not least of which is 300,000-400,000 reservists being mobilized. So also, you know, a war footing is also a literal war footing. And also, yes, a lot of the people from either southern Israel or northern Israel, like you mentioned, with the threat of a possible northern front opening up, have been displaced. So you have Israel has been very careful not to release official numbers. And even the official number, I think it was 100,000 from southern Israel, seems quite low. They haven't released the official number, but yes, people have moved to other parts of the country. Some people are down in Eilat, the Dead Sea, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, even kind of north of Tel Aviv, in various communities and hotels, even down the street from my flat in central Tel Aviv. There's a hotel, and I went there down the street to check on the restaurant the other night. And the restaurant was actually open, but they told me that it wasn't for outside customers. It was only for people staying at the hotel, and it was for only the people displaced from Sderot in southern Israel. So essentially, the restaurant and the hotel were housing and feeding all these families displaced from Sderot. And yes, there is a tent city, as it were, being set up in the Kfar HaMakabiyah, which is in Ramat Gan, because yes, it is. There aren't enough hotel rooms, and there have also been reports of various hotels who have not been willing to open their doors as of yet, which seems ridiculous. But yes, everyone is preparing for this to go on for quite some time. And we need to remember, too, a lot of these communities in southern Israel were completely destroyed. So it will take time in and of itself just to rebuild those communities, when this war eventually ends.
Thank you for that, Nairi. Speaking of the humanitarian element component of this war, can you shed some light on the humanitarian situation in Gaza? Because there's a lot of confusion, at least for me, about who is actually responsible for water, fuel, electricity, border crossings. It would seem to me that Israel is, of course, holds a lot of weight there. But if there is also Egypt, there is also an international community. So many on the Israeli side would say, and we do hear saying, that they're not responsible for this entirely. And of course, there is a border crossing at Rafah with Egypt. So what is their role in all of this? I read this morning that there are, I believe, over 1,000 or close to 2 dual citizens and folks who do not live or not residents of Gaza. They're either dual citizens or they may not be Palestinian at all, who are waiting to enter Egypt and they're not allowed out. So what is the role that Egypt's playing in all of this? To what extent is Israel actually in control of all of these elements of humanitarian aid? And who is, I'll ask the rest of this question later, actually answer that part first.
Okay, so a lot to unpack. So obviously the situation inside Gaza is very dire. We shouldn't sugarcoat that. It has been a very intensive Israeli air campaign targeting Hamas installations, fighters, command centers, and the like, which are, we need to note, fully embedded inside apartment blocks, next to hospitals, next to mosques. Hamas does this very, very deliberately, to say nothing of the vast underground, tunnels isn't the right word. There are vast underground cities, multiple cities, I've been told, underneath Gaza that Hamas built over years at great expense to house its own military forces. And so that is what they were spending their money on for well over 15 years since they violently took control of Gaza. So situation is quite dire. I'm not reporting from Gaza, and all we have to go by is either a Hamas-run health ministry or aid organizations that work inside Gaza. Fuel is a primary concern, number one, because that that runs a lot of the hospitals, that runs the UN workers and aid agencies inside the Strip to move around supplies. It's also an issue of drinking water and just medicine and food. It is a real concern, and Israel from the very beginning said, and I'm quoting the defense minister, that it was going to lay siege around Gaza. Now, that's a euphemism, as it were, but, in practicality, yes, nothing has gone in or out from the Israeli side since October 7th. We should also say that Hamas destroyed the border crossings on October 7th, both Erez, which is for pedestrians and people, and the Kerem Shalom crossing. That was one of the primary and first points of contact for Hamas fighters. They destroyed those crossings. So in a physical sense, it's very difficult or near impossible to get anything in, even if Israel were willing, which it is not willing. We've tried to get an explanation as to the military logic behind the siege and not allowing anything in. And to the best of my understanding, medicine and fuel and water are still available inside Gaza. Again, there's no way for me to actually verify that. Fuel, the Israeli military has been very clear, is a different matter altogether. Because according to the IDF, that fuels the Hamas military machine and it allows them to sustain themselves below ground in those underground cities. And so in terms of a military objective, the IDF, at least for now, has been very clear that it will not allow fuel into the Gaza Strip. Now, on the other side of the ledger, yes, you're right. There is a border crossing with Egypt, the Rafah crossing. Several convoys of aid trucks have gone in over the past week. The international journalists here cover that very closely. I'd say, not enough aid convoys have gone in. And so the question is, what is the holdup? Where is the bottleneck? And this has been true, I think, from the start of the war, that the there's kind of diplomatic cul-de-sac going on between Israel and Egypt and essentially Hamas, where Egypt wants more aid to go in, right? Egypt is, you know, demanding essentially more relief for Gaza. By the way, the Americans, and not only the Americans, want to get foreign nationals out of Gaza, like you mentioned before, and Israel very much not so much limiting aid other than fuel, but it wants to inspect the trucks going in. And so for now, there's this kind of standoff diplomatically where, you know, we haven't reached, you know, the requisite deal to kind of square the circle. My sense slash hope is that at some point Israel will begin allowing more humanitarian aid into Gaza. And by the way, the IDF has been very clear that it's willing to allow that kind of aid other than fuel again into southern Gaza, which it's been repeatedly calling for residents of northern Gaza to move to as this kind of humanitarian safe zones being established in southern Gaza. At some point, they'll likely allow more aid in. But again, there's no way for us to kind of verify it. But the IDF says, you know, there is enough, there is fuel still in Gaza. It just happens to be controlled by Hamas, and that Hamas isn't willing to give that fuel for civilian needs, for hospitals and the like. And that there is still food, water, medicine available inside Gaza. But again, that will, you know, as this goes along, that will likely change. And so I expect Israel to allow more humanitarian aid into the Strip. But fuel will be a major sticking point. It already is a sticking point. And yes, you know, just final point, Egypt has been very clear too, right? That it doesn't want a massive outflow of Gazans to go through the Rafah crossing into Egypt's Sinai peninsula. And so that's a major concern for Egypt. And it could also explain the reason why it hasn't yet been willing to open up the crossing, because, you know, how do you stop hundreds, thousands of people trying to find sanctuary in Sinai. So again, a very, very difficult issues within the context of Israel waging war against a terrorist group that A, controls the entire Gaza Strip, and B, is fully embedded and meshed in this territory's civilian population on purpose. The worst things are inside Gaza, and we've seen this in all of the previous rounds between Israel and Hamas. Militarily, it serves their overall strategic goals of putting a diplomatic clock on Israel, where, you know, global pressure mounts and mounts due to the very dire humanitarian situation inside Gaza. And then eventually Israel has to stop its military campaign. That has always been a strategic objective of Hamas. This time, obviously, given the atrocious events of October 7th and the steadfast support of the Biden administration, you know, Israel likely has more time to prosecute this war against Hamas than it had previously. But, you know, it's not unlimited, I'd imagine. And like President Biden and his senior aides have said, Israel has every right to defend itself and to go and, I'm paraphrasing, but destroy Hamas as a military threat to Israel. But it also very much matters how Israel goes about doing that, how it prosecutes this war.
Thank you for that, Neri. I want to move us back to the humanitarian crisis just for a moment to ask you, who is actually checking what enters at the Rafah crossing through Egypt into Gaza? Because there is a lot of mistrust between Israel and the UN. I know a lot of that came up just this week with Israel criticizing the UN Secretary General Guterres for some of his remarks. So what is the role of UN agencies in all of this? Because we do hear a lot of reports, and of course you just verified them in some way, that Hamas steals so many of the necessities that are coming in for their own fighters and seems to have not limitless, but plenty of supplies for their own fighters and is not willing to share it with hospitals and where it's really direly needed. So what is the system put in place, or is there one, to ensure that doesn't continue to happen as aid enters into the Strip?
So again, the Israeli military has said that Hamas has stolen UN supplies. Again, there's no way for me to verify that, but it is out there, like you allude to. The issue of inspections. So basically, right before the Rafah crossing is where the Egyptian, Israeli, and Gazan border meet. And to the best of my understanding, there are Israeli forces or Israeli agents there that have checked at least one of the convoys that have gone in recent days. So there is some kind of inspection mechanism on Egyptian territory before those trucks reach Rafah and then into Gaza. But again, no fuel. No fuel, just food, medicine, and other aid. So that's essentially how it's been working. The aid organizations, for their part, have said, you know, a lot more needs to come in. So right now it's been somewhat of a trickle. But again, you know, we're less than, this is the third week, but we're not quite at the 3 week mark of this war. And it will likely go on for quite a lot longer. So, at some point, you know, the supplies inside Gaza will be depleted. And then it's a question of, okay, this aid will go in, I assume primarily to southern Gaza. And Israel says it, you know, it is checking before it goes in, and it's monitoring what happens to this aid after it goes in. Will Hamas try to steal it for its own fighters, for its own military purposes? What will the world's reaction be if and when that happens? I'll be very curious to follow that wrinkle in terms of how Hamas conducts itself inside Gaza for a population that it was ostensibly responsible for. Obviously, it was wholly responsible bringing this war on the innocent people of Gaza. We need to also remember that this was a strategic choice, like I said last week, by Hamas to wage total war on Israel and primarily southern Israel. And so the reaction by Israel, again, in self-defense, should have been taken into account. The welfare of the Gazan people should have been taken into account by what the international community calls the de facto authority, i.e. Hamas. So for years, it was viewed as the de facto authority. It was the address, the sovereign of Gaza. This is what it decided to do, again, for its own purposes. And then the issue of the UN and what Secretary General Gutierrez said yesterday, obviously, that's very much been in the news. It's definitely been in the news in Israel. Wall-to-wall condemnation and anger by Israelis at the comments. I'll say a couple things. Number one, I guess on the more positive side of the ledger, Gutierrez, everyone quoted his initial remark saying, you know, this didn't happen in a vacuum. This is 56 years of occupation. Again, I'm paraphrasing. The second clause that he said was right after that, but nothing can justify the attacks of October 7th. So that's also important to keep in mind. But on the other side of the ledger, a bit more critical, the Secretary General should know better than others that Hamas does not see the situation like he does. Hamas doesn't tell time from 1967 and the occupation and the conquest of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Hamas sees it going back to 1948. So the Secretary General might view it that way as kind of the overall context, but that's not how Hamas views it. And the notion that Hamas, again, this alludes to back to our conversation last week, for the overall kind of political context within which October 7th happened and Israel-Gaza relations going back to the Hamas takeover of 2007 of the territory. Just look at what Hamas was doing in the 1990s. In the early 1990s, in the heyday of the peace process, the Oslo era, it was blowing up buses and cafes and discotheques and everything it could before there was a far-right government in Israel. Before Itamar Ben-Gvir and, you know, Bezalel Smotrich were senior ministers, before, you know, the settlements expanded like we all know they did, you know, especially over the past 25 years. So it wasn't like Hamas was waiting for a peace process to come to fruition and to see, you know, what the intentions were of the Israeli government of the day in order to start waging a terror campaign against Israeli civilians. So the notion that Hamas views it the same way as the Secretary General is ridiculous. And just a final point, people who were living in Israel in the mid-1990s, and especially in the lead up to the 1996 election, fully remember that spring where buses were blowing up, as Israelis say, every Tuesday and Thursday. And that was a major, major factor, if not the factor, in getting Benjamin Netanyahu elected for the first time as prime minister, and Shimon Peres losing by less than one percentage point. So again, it wasn't like Hamas is waiting, like I said, to gauge Israeli intentions and, you know, really, really hoping that a left-wing Israeli prime minister would come to power or remain in power back then in order to negotiate a two-state solution with Israel. Right. And so in terms of context and all the, you know, protests going on all over the world, you're backing the wrong horse here. Right. Hamas is not interested in peace. It's not interested in coexistence. It's not interested in the occupation of the West Bank. And by the way, we should also not forget, Israel withdrew completely settlers and army from the Gaza Strip in 2005 to internationally recognized borders. So all the talk about ending the occupation, like the Secretary General was alluding to, again, Hamas does not see it that way. And so there will be no peace in the Holy Land if Hamas remains a major military force, controlling actual territory. People really need to understand the broader context and take these groups and these extremist Islamists and jihadists at their word and not try to view it through a Western prism through the east side of New York.
Absolutely. It surely seems that the ideological component of Hamas's motivations is really lost on a lot of the onlookers from my side of the world, which is very troubling. And of course, all of these claims that Hamas is attempting to end the occupation completely ignore the fact that they were the exact spoilers in so many previous attempts to end the occupation. And 100%. I think that seems to be lost on so many in how we discuss it in the conflict over the conflict, as they say, which is something that many of us in the United States are embroiled in, and really across the world, unfortunately, being dragged into these discussions that are really lack historical context or start historical context a little bit too late in the game.
Yeah. And to bring this on a more kind of down to earth personal level, a lot of the kibbutzim that were invaded and literally slaughtered on October 7th, a lot of those people were left-wing Israelis, very much peace activists. Many, many peace activists that I've interviewed either are being held hostage in Gaza right now, like the husband of the woman who was released the other day. The left-wing kibbutzim and all those people very much did not vote for, you know, Ben-Gvir or even Bibi Netanyahu. They voted for other parties on the left side of the spectrum. A lot of them were just killed outright in their homes, again, on sovereign, internationally recognized Israeli territory. And, you know, I was alluding to my interviews with the survivors from Kfar Aza, Kibbutz Kfar Aza, the other week that I went to interview. And the one woman that I was interviewing, Batya, she, on her own initiative, a couple of years ago, set up a joint photography exhibition in Kibbutz Nachalot, a neighboring kibbutz, with a photographer from Gaza as a sign of kind of coexistence for a more hopeful future. That was on her initiative, and they displayed pictures of, on Batya's side, it was kind of sunsets and the fields outside Kibbutz Kfar Aza, and for her Palestinian interlocutor, it was you know, scenes of Gaza and Gaza City, and that exhibit went on for quite a few months in Nachalot, right? And this woman Batya wanted something very different for both her community and also for Gazans, and a lot of her neighbors were either murdered in their homes quite viciously, as we all know, or are now being held hostage.
Moving us towards the potential ground invasion of Gaza, I'd like to try to get in the head. And I know the cruelest thing you can do to an analyst is ask them to make predictions or get in the heads of politicians, but I will still do that to you anyway and ask what is going on with Netanyahu, who is, of course, very anxious about a potential ground invasion. He's very aversive to risks like these. And despite that, it seems the nation is quite antsy to figure out what the war strategy is going to look like. Now, there's, of course, the role that Biden is playing in all of this. He's encouraging a pause and a focus on releasing the hostages, in addition to suggesting, I would say rightfully so, not to enter Gaza without a clear exit strategy. Obviously, all of this makes a lot of sense, but it does seem regardless that Netanyahu is very reluctant to move forward. So what is your sense of the plans ahead? What's impacting these decisions? I spent the last few days in Washington speaking with analysts, and everyone sort of, there was almost a consensus that a ground invasion is necessary and also disastrous at the same time. So are there any unknowns that are going to reveal themselves in the coming days that you believe the government is waiting on in order to decide? Or are they simply waiting for more hostages to be released and they're too anxious to make the decision right away?
So your question is well taken, because everyone here, and obviously not just here, is waiting for a major ground incursion by the IDF into the Gaza Strip that really, in the wake of October 7th and the mobilization of the entire military here, seemed imminent. But that obviously hasn't happened. And we're now almost 3 weeks removed from what's come to be known as Black Saturday here in Israel. So the question is why? Why the delay? To the best of my understanding, and I've obviously been reporting on this very heavily, especially over the past week and a half, there are a couple of factors. So number one, obviously the Biden administration is counseling patience. And as I reported with my colleague Felicia Swartz in the Financial Times yesterday, they want to see a coherent exit strategy and plan for post-war Gaza from the Israelis. Now, it's not just an Israeli, or rather an American request. This is also a demand put forward by Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot when they joined the emergency national government, the war cabinet that's running this war, that was literally in the coalition agreement. So it's not just American pressure, but the people here at the top, and also people, senior people in Washington, want to know when the IDF will know that it's achieved its objectives and how it intends to leave Gaza, and it very much wants to leave Gaza and not reoccupy it once again indefinitely after those objectives are met. And that needs to be thought through. To the best of our reporting, that is still no decision, no plan has yet been formulated or agreed to. So that's one major reason why a ground operation hasn't been launched yet. You know, sending tanks into Gaza may make the Israeli public feel better, but the generals actually running this war need to know what to tell those tanks to do once they're in, that the exit strategy and post-war order should and likely will very much inform the scope and nature of the actual ground operation. So that's number one. Number two, and this is also related to the Biden administration, the possibility of releasing more hostages. And this is, go back to your first question, it's a very shrewd play by Hamas to kind of keep dangling the prospect of more hostages being released, which everyone is very grateful for. But, there may be another hostage release tonight. And so, okay, there may be another hostage release in a few nights. And so if there's still a possibility of getting more out or a deal being had, then it's worth waiting. Number three, and this is something less talked about, October 7th caught everyone by surprise, but also, and obviously, the IDF. And so to get the IDF and especially the reserve army into top fighting form requires time. So all those masses of infantry and armor and special forces and like massed in southern Israel, and by the way, not just in southern Israel, but also in northern Israel, are training and preparing. And again, that's probably all for the good, because it's going to be a very, very difficult ground operation if and when the order is given. By the way, we should mention the top generals, the military officers here are publicly saying now for several days when they get asked repeatedly, why hasn't a ground operation started yet? They say, we're ready. We're ready. And we're just waiting for a decision by the political echelon. Which is probably accurate. Number four, the fourth reason, there is an assumption, again, it remains to be tested, that once the ground operation begins, that increases the possibility and likelihood of Hezbollah escalating in the north, and maybe not just Hezbollah, maybe other Iranian militias and proxies around Israel. And so in and of itself, that's not going to deter Israel from from launching the ground operation, which I still believe will happen at some point. But it requires a bit more careful planning, a bit more careful preparation, both by Israel, in terms of just the home front especially. It requires more time for the U.S. military to prepare its various assets all over the region. And so that's also a factor. So all those things put together, we're all still waiting for a ground operation to start. And look, there has been, you know, reports, speculation that maybe Netanyahu is not going to give a green light, reported, you know, differences of opinion between him and the other members of the war cabinet. I think that's a bit overblown. Even Netanyahu, who is very, shall we say, cautious. There's another adjective, but I'm not going to use it. He's been very cautious with the use of military force, despite his, you know, international reputation, and especially the deployment of ground forces. Netanyahu has never actually given the order for a major, major ground operation in the long, long years that he's been prime minister. They've always been very, very limited ground maneuvers. And this time, I don't even think his caution will be able to stop any kind of ground operation for two reasons. Number one, the IDF has told him, and not him, but the politicians flat out, we can't meet the objectives you set. Dismantling Hamas as both a military and governing force in the Gaza Strip without a major ground operation. And number two, the Israeli public just won't stand for it. The Israeli public will not stand for it after the atrocious events of October 7th. And so politically, I don't think he has any real wiggle room to, keep an aerial campaign going for a few more weeks and then call it a day and leave some semblance of Hamas control in Gaza. Again, other analysts differ from my point of view, but it remains to be seen.
Let's move to the West Bank now, which is, of course, extremely volatile and enormously impacted by how events are going to unfold in the Gaza Strip with the IDF. We mentioned this a bit in our last episode, and I think the way the Palestinian Authority is going to be responding and the stability of their security forces and the potential for them to break down during this critical moment is on the minds of everyone. And of course, for, I would say, about once a year for many years, you hear threats from the Palestinian Authority, discussions of how weak their security forces are, their inability to maintain control of large parts of the West Bank, including massive refugee camps or even cities, you could call them, in Jenin and Nablus. You, of course, wrote a report with Haith al-Omari bunch of years ago, you correct me, I believe it was maybe 2018, which was about the forces themselves, their coordination with the IDF, which is also managed by the U.S. military. And I think one of the most optimistic options for the future of Gaza is the Palestinian Authority takeover eventually. That's one of the potential exit strategies with which Yair Lapid mentioned. And of course, there are many constraints to that, but one of them is obviously the erosion of the PA security capabilities, alongside, of course, their lack of credibility, authoritarianism, corruption, et cetera. But the security capabilities are a really enormous piece of this, and they're clearly very depleted, having lost control of so much of their territory. And in light of all of that, what has the PA's role been? Because Israel's making arrests and killing Hamas terrorists in the West Bank, breaking up terror cells, right? Technically, that should be the PA's jurisdiction, but of course they're unwilling or unable to do so. So in light of all of that, where do you see the PA's role in all of this? How are they handling the situation?
So I'll answer your question, but we should have maybe done this at the top, but just to do kind of a around the horn state of play in terms of the actual war going on here. So we talked about Gaza, no ground operation, but obviously continued heavy Israeli air campaign against Gaza and Hamas targets in Gaza, and also sporadic rocket fire here and there. It's actually a bit weird. The first week and a half was very intensive rocket fire from Gaza, even, you know, into central Israel and Tel Aviv. It's gotten a bit quieter. I don't think the pace Hamas and Islamic Jihad were on in terms of their rocket fire was sustainable. So I think they're kind of holding their fire. And so some life or sense of normality has returned to, you know, central Israel. Some schools are back in a limited format. More people are just out in the streets, a bit more traffic. People are in the cafes. So in terms of just what's happening, again, not in northern Israel or southern Israel, but in central Israel, you know, very much unlike really the first stages of the war. It's kind of a weird interregnum, like I said, where everyone's waiting for the ground operation to start. And having said that, you know, there were three major barrages at central Israel yesterday. I don't think there has been one yet today, knock on wood. And in the north, still clashes between the IDF and Hezbollah. Hezbollah keeps trying to fire anti-tank missiles at Israeli forces and even sometimes civilians. IDF has shown, I think, a better response time and has actually hit a lot of these cells. I think Hezbollah, the latest count, has lost over 50 personnel, 50 fighters since October 7th, which is not a small number. And also some sporadic rocket fire, short range mortars and the like against northern Israeli communities, but nothing like, you know, what it would be like if Hezbollah really entered the fray. We also saw, I think it was after we recorded last week, I think the Houthi militia in Yemen fired some missiles and drones in the direction of Israel, and that was intercepted by the U.S. Navy in the Red Sea. Thank you very much for that, U.S. Navy. So again, the threat of, you know, other Iranian proxies ever present, also from Syria. And then finally, we reached the West Bank, and the West Bank is not calm by any stretch of the imagination. It's just less in the news, given all the focus on Gaza and the north and Lebanon. So there have been major Israeli arrest operations almost every night targeting Hamas, not only terrorists, but also activists. They're really going after Hamas hard in the West Bank as well. As one official told me, I think yesterday, the gloves are off. The gloves are off on all fronts, and also in the West Bank, vis-a-vis Hamas and other terrorist and militant groups. And we've seen as well, you know, some protests, some demonstrations against both Israel and the PA, we should add, against President Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, especially in the wake of the explosion at the hospital, which we talked about last week, which turned out to be almost certainly a failed launch or misfire by Islamic Jihad, despite what some media outlets reported. I think the Israel Policy Pod got it right last week. But yes, so, you know, demonstrations, you know, clashes between IDF and Palestinians. I think some 100 Palestinians in the West Bank have been killed since October 7th, a major, major number. Now, some are terrorists and militants killed in IDF arrest operations or trying to attack Israelis. Some just killed in clashes with Israeli security forces, and some also, as we alluded to last week, either injured or killed by extremist settlers out for revenge, which is not only unacceptable, but illegal, immoral, and those people need to be stopped. And this was more of a case, I think, in the first week, but it's definitely still a phenomenon that needs to be reined in, is putting it mildly. Obviously. So that's what's happening in the West Bank. But having said all of that, it could be a lot worse. The PA security forces and the PA, I think on their end, are trying to contain the protests and to contain the demonstrations, not least because some of it is directed against them and some of it is very much Hamas in the West Bank. So it's a direct threat to PA and Fatah party rule. But we haven't seen, and this is goes back to the point about the passive, we haven't seen, like we saw, say, in the opening stages of the Second Intifada in the early 2000s, where the PA, including the security forces and Fatah, actively joined the war, actively joined the campaign. And we haven't seen, to the best of my knowledge, one instance of that, maybe here and there. There may be a case that I've just missed because... you know, 20-hour days, 7 days a week for 3 weeks catches up to you. But they still, on the whole, seem to be following orders, still remain disciplined. And so in terms of the West Bank opening up and erupting as yet another front, that hasn't happened. But the Israeli military and other security forces, you know, central command of the IDF responsible for the West Bank, is also on its part, you know, on its terms, going to war against Hamas in the West Bank.
Well, on that light note,
it could be worse, Shani. It could be worse. And by the way, we should also mention in terms of fronts, Arab Israelis, you know, Palestinian citizens of Israel, in what's called here mixed cities, you know, Arab Jewish cities and towns, completely quiet.
Absolutely.
Completely quiet. And I think that's all for the good, and should also be a testament to the fact that Palestinians, whether in the territories or inside Israel, you know, are not Hamas, don't support Hamas. You know, they obviously have, I know this firsthand, very strong opinions about the Israeli campaign in Gaza. But in terms of where they're at ideologically, you know, just like I still choose to believe that the vast majority of Gazans don't support Hamas and don't want to see, you know, the events of October 7th done in their name. You know, I still choose to believe that's true for the vast majority of Palestinians, wherever they are. Again, I understand their point of view as well about, you know, the Israeli military campaign and the scenes they're seeing from inside Gaza. Again, it's a very, very difficult moment on all sides of this very, very difficult issue. But as we've tried to preach here on the Israel Policy Pod, October 7th was a intentional decision by Hamas, by a specific extremist Islamist group, done for God knows its own objectives, its own purposes, and Israel, I'd argue rightfully, in self-defense, can no longer live with a Gaza Strip controlled by this organization.
We actually mentioned in one of the early, I think our last podcast, that a major concern that I've been thinking about was the reaction of Arab Israelis. So it's been so pleasant and lovely to see sort of the mass mobilization of Palestinian citizens of Israel to kind of be part of this civil society effort during the war, which has been really a bright spot.
Yeah.
Nery, I know you've been...
And it also... By the way, Shani, it also comes out of a misconception about what happened in May 2021, a misconception fueled by right-wing extremist Israelis, especially the politicians like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, where the notion back then in the May 2021 Israel-Hamas war was that Arab Israelis and, you know, obviously the intercommunal riots in a lot of these mixed cities that I referred to came about because they were standing in solidarity with Hamas and what was happening in Gaza, where the reality was it was more a reaction to what the far right ultra-nationalist settlers and their ilk were doing in Jerusalem at Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Temple Mount compound, and in East Jerusalem. So again, it's a misunderstanding of what actually happened in May 2021.
Thank you for that, Nery. I know you've been speaking with so many of the displaced people, so many of the hostage families. You've really been in the field on and off for the past 3 weeks. So I'd love for you to share maybe some sort of hopeful story in any way that you've heard so that we can end on a more positive note.
Yeah, I mean, I the more hopeful part of it, I think, is just the resilience and solidarity being exhibited by just regular Israelis. Regular Israelis, like we're talking about, that banded together. And through a very difficult time, you see everywhere you look, just, you know, glimmers of hope and you know, even Israelis who are, you know, oftentimes have kind of sharper elbows. It seems like those elbows have been softened a little bit. People kind of a bit more patient, despite the fact that everyone is under immense strain and pressure. And I don't want to kind of sugarcoat that, but that people are there for each other. And, you know, I've seen and heard stories of, you know, not just people bringing food to the troops, but also people going to funerals, of friends or relatives, or even people they you know, barely connected to, or even perfect strangers, or making Shiva calls, or taking a bereaved mother who lost her son on a shopping trip, you know, just to kind of get her, I don't want to say normalcy, but just back into human society. And you hear those stories again and again. You know, it's a choir going and singing at one of these hotels for the people and survivors from southern Israel, and on and on and on. The examples are endless, and that does give you hope in terms of the solidarity, the solidity, the resilience of this society in the wake of October 7th. And also, it's interesting, there was a poll by our friends from the Israel Democracy Institute that came out yesterday. And one figure jumped out at me was that they asked Israelis, are you optimistic about the future of this country? And 65% of Israelis, now granted Jewish Israelis, but also not an insignificant amount of Arab Israelis, said they were. 65%. And what's more interesting is that this was about 15 points higher in terms of optimism for the future of the country than Israelis responded in June, in the summer, in the kind of depths of the crisis over the judicial overhaul. So during these 3 weeks of war, Israelis have become even more optimistic about the future of this country. And I think that says a lot about the mindset of everyone here. And also just in terms of, kind of not a return to normalcy, because nothing right now is normal here, but Eretz Nehederet, a lovely country. I think that's the right translation. Basically, Israel's version of SNL, of Saturday Night Live, is putting on in a few hours on Channel 12 here, a wartime special. So, the first two weeks or so, it was very much, nonstop coverage of the victims, of relatives of those taken hostage, and you still have that. But interspersed with that is a lot of, I would say, kind of morale-boosting interviews and something like Eretz Nehederet, meant to kind of buck up people's spirits. And kind of, interviews with the soldiers on the front, acting a bit goofy or things like that. So again, I don't want to say time heals all wounds, because it will take a long, long time for this country to heal from October 7th. And also, we're in the middle of a war. So this weird kind of quieter interregnum will likely not last. But we need to appreciate it while it's still here. At least that's my approach as I continue working around the clock.
That's extremely special. Thank you for sharing that, Neri. And I definitely, this is what we would call in the American Jewish communal celebrating Jewish joy. I don't know if you'd even recognize that phrase, but it's something that a lot of folks here have been talking about, which is this having, first of all, this deep sense of certainty that even in the depths of despair, the Jewish people are eternal and not going anywhere, even when rational thought would point us towards being enormously depressed and even, thinking terrible thoughts. We have this deep sense of certainty that we will survive it and we will come out ahead of it in the end. So I appreciate that. And Israeli society is certainly representing that in this moment.
It is. And I should mention that for people here in Israel, again, I'm only speaking for myself as a journalist observing it, but obviously maybe a bit more than that. The solidarity shown by not just American Jews, but Jews all over the world during this time for Israel hasn't gone unnoticed. And it's a huge part of what we're talking about in terms of, the solidarity shown. And, again, it could be something simple as, coverage of rallies in support of the hostages, to get the hostages out in New York. It could be money, sent to Israel, donations and the like. It can be anything, but it definitely makes a huge impact. And I think also Israelis, again, I'm speaking as a reporter observing it, Israelis are also very aware that it's a very difficult time for Jewish diaspora communities all over the world, trying to kind of navigate both the actual war and then the reaction to the war all over the world. Don't think that it's not appreciated. And again, you can very much feel distress, feel empathy for innocent Gazans and what they're going through. While also very much keeping in mind, as we try to stress here on the Israel Policy Pod, that this didn't come out of nowhere, that there was both a political and, on October 7th, a military context to the situation we all find ourselves in right now.
Thank you for that, Neri. I hope that we have some more good news to report, or any good news to report, next week when we chat.
I do as well, Shani. Take care.
On October 7th, 2023, Israelis faced the unthinkable when Hamas militants breached the Gaza border, carried out a violent rampage, took hundreds of Israelis and other foreign citizens hostage, and indiscriminately slaughtered at least 1,400 people, mostly civilians, many of them women, children, and elderly. This conflict has upended Israeli society and exacerbated an already dire humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip, where thousands of Palestinians have already been killed by Israeli airstrikes and misfired rockets launched by militants. As Israelis and Palestinians gird themselves for the war ahead, and we all process the traumatic events of the past 2 weeks, Israel Policy Forum experts have been providing timely, clear-headed, and sober analysis on the ongoing conflict. For all of our resources on the ongoing Israel-Hamas war, including a timeline of events from 1949 until now, explore our new Israel at War webpage. Links to all of these resources can be found in the show notes of this podcast. For more analysis, visit israelpolicyforum.org.